Hello, everyone. My name is Hannah, and you're listening to Mystic and Murder, a paranormal, unexplained, and true crime podcast. On today's episode, we will be diving into two different escapes from Alcatraz. This episode will be a two-parter, so stay tuned. Before we get started, I just want to take a minute to say if you are enjoying this podcast and you're listening on a platform that allows you to rate and review like Apple Podcast, please do. I would appreciate it so much and I'd love to hear your thoughts on the podcast. Now, let's dive into all things weird. I first visited Alcatraz in 2010 and I became obsessed. This land has such an interesting history behind it. It was used in the Civil War era, it served as a federal penitentiary, families lived in housing right by the main cell house when it was a prison, and once the prison was shut down, it was taken over and occupied by a group of Native American activists for more than 19 months. Currently, Alcatraz is a national park, and it's known to be haunted. Now, this isn't a paranormal episode, but that's definitely something that I'll cover in the future. If you've never heard of Alcatraz, you may be a bit confused as to why anyone would turn a prison into a park, but once you learn more about it, I think you'll understand. Alcatraz Penitentiary served as a maximum security, minimum privilege federal prison from 1934 to 1963. This quote-unquote super prison opened on January 1st, 1934. There's a famous saying that goes, "Break the laws of society, and you go to prison. Break the prison rules, and you go to Alcatraz." Alcatraz housed the most notorious and dangerous criminals like Al Capone, Machine Gun Kelly, Robert Stroud, Roy Gardner, and Whitey Bulger, to name a few. It also housed inmates who had either tried to escape or had successfully escaped from other prisons. Alcatraz was extremely difficult to escape from. It had the highest guard-to-prisoner ratio in the country, with one guard to every three prisoners. Elevated gun galleries overlooked the prison cells, and each of the 338 cells had bars made of tool-proof steel, which also covered any windows in the cell house. The only windows in Alcatraz were on the exterior of the building, which none of the cells touched. The cells were stacked three stories high in the center of the prison, and they were separated in blocks A, B, C, and D. They were 5 feet wide, 9 feet deep, and 7 feet tall. Prisoners were locked in their cells from 6 p.m. to 7 a.m. every night. If they did manage to somehow get outside of the prison, there were five guard towers overlooking it. But the best feature of Alcatraz, and the one that made it hardest to escape, was the surrounding water. Alcatraz Island, also known as The Rock, sits in the middle of San Francisco Bay in California. If a prisoner did manage to escape, their only way off the island would be to swim over a mile in any direction to reach land. Even if they were great swimmers, this would be an extremely difficult feat because the water in the bay ranges from 50 to 60 degrees Fahrenheit, depending on the time of year. Because of this, prisoners of Alcatraz got to enjoy nice, hot showers. The guards didn't want them to be able to acclimate to colder temperatures that would mimic a swim in the bay. Guards also told the prisoners that these waters were infested with man-eating sharks. While there are 21 different species of sharks in the bay, including great whites, the chance of getting attacked by a shark is pretty rare. The earliest shark attack in the bay dates all the way back to 1851. Another attack happened in 1926, and the third and most recent attack happened in 1956. None of the attacks were fatal. So the man-eating shark bit was more so a scare tactic than anything else. The chance of getting swept out into the Pacific by a strong ocean current or being pulled under by a riptide were much more realistic causes of death, along with hypothermia from the cold temperatures of the bay. If you weren't in great shape and you weren't a strong swimmer, chances of making it to shore were slim. That didn't stop the prisoners from trying to make it out, though. In the 29 years that Alcatraz Penitentiary was open, there were 14 different escape attempts made by 36 prisoners. They often worked together. Out of the 14 attempts, only 4 men tried to go it alone. Most of the time, their plans failed. Out of the 36 prisoners, 23 were captured, 7 of them died trying, 1 prisoner's body was recovered from the bay about 2 weeks after he had escaped, and 5 of them are missing and presumed dead. Today, we are going to talk about those 5 missing prisoners and the mystery behind their escapes. You may have already heard about one of these attempts. It's a well-known escape, partially because of the mystery behind it all, and partially because of the 1979 movie called Escape from Alcatraz, starring Clint Eastwood. Before we get into that, I want to tell you about the lesser-known escape that happened 25 years earlier. In Alcatraz's second-ever escape attempt, 2 prisoners named Theodore Cole and Ralph Rowe managed to file through the iron bars of the prison's mat shop. This shop was located in the island's industrial building, which stands separate from the cell house. Theodore, Ted, Cole, and Ralph Rowe both had an extensive history of crime, and both had tried to, or successfully had, escaped from prison before. Before his time at Alcatraz, Ted Cole had committed several armed robberies and had wounded a police officer. Thankfully, the shot was non-fatal. The judge who handled the case thought that Cole was a potential killer and should be treated as such. Cole was sentenced with the death penalty, which led to nationwide protests. He hadn't actually killed someone, though he had shot at the officer. Due to the protest, his sentence was reduced from a death penalty to 15 years in prison. While he was serving time in the Oklahoma State Penitentiary in McAllister, he killed his cellmate with a homemade knife. His attorney somehow managed to convince the jury that it was self-defense, despite the 27 stab wounds he inflicted. For this, he was sentenced to 50 years. He managed to escape the Oklahoma State Penitentiary by hiding in a laundry bag, which was loaded onto a truck and taken out of the prison. He was free for a few months before he took someone hostage, stole a car, and committed more robberies. He was captured and extradited back to Oklahoma, where he tried to escape the county jail that he was being held in during his trial by sawing through some of the bars on the window of his cell. He openly bragged that he was going to escape, and a special microphone was then installed in his cell to detect any unusual sounds. After his trial, he was transferred to United States Penitentiary Leavenworth, a high-security prison in Kansas, where he would stay until he was transferred to Alcatraz in October of 1936. His escape partner, Ralph Rowe, was also transferred to Alcatraz in October of 1936. In fact, they were transported there on the same train. The two had spent time incarcerated together at Leavenworth, and prior to that, they had become friends while serving time at McAllister. Ralph was also a known escape risk. While at McAllister, Rowe had a failed escape attempt. He tried to hide in a utility crate that would be nailed shut, and his plan would have worked, but he realized that he was starting to suffocate inside the crate, and his plans were thwarted. Rowe's criminal activity started at the age of 18. Like Cole, he was also a convicted robber. After his first offense, he was sent to a reform school where he escaped and went on the run. He evaded capture and committed more robberies with higher levels of violence. The one that landed him a 99-year sentence was a bank robbery in 1934 in which he and an accomplice had taken hostages, making it a federal crime. He was first held in United States Penitentiary Leavenworth when it was recommended that he spend the remainder of his sentence at Alcatraz. Roe was not a model prisoner, or even close to it. He has a lengthy conduct report at Alcatraz. He had tried to strike when assigned to work in the mat shop. He had several incidents of provoking and yelling at the guards involving the removal of blankets from his cell. He was a noisy prisoner despite the silence ordinances and the prison rules. Still, he kept his assignment in the mat shop, where Cole was also assigned to work. The two worked side by side in the shop, which repurposed worn-out car tires into dense rubber floor mats that were used by the Navy. Roe and Cole spent weeks planning and watching the patterns and habits of the guards and identifying the weak spots in the security system. In the weeks before their escape, they stole a hacksaw blade and managed to saw through a steel window grill when the guards weren't looking. They covered up the gaps with grease and shoe polish to avoid detection. December 16, 1937 began like any other day. Roe and Cole had spent the morning working in the shop, ate lunch in the mess hall, and then returned to the shop with the other prisoners around 12:50 p.m. to continue their assignment. The guard took his usual count of all the inmates and then left to oversee the blacksmith shop as he had split patrol duties. When the guard left, Roe and Cole decided it was time to make a break for it. The guard returned at 1:30 and he did a head count again, only to discover that Roe and Cole were missing. He quickly searched the shop and discovered a window grill had been bent, presumably by a stolen wrench, and some of the glass panes on the window were broken. The escape alarm was sounded for the second time in Alcatraz history, and an extensive search was launched. They were no longer on the island. It was determined that due to the extreme fog that day, Roe and Cole had gone undetected by the guard towers as well. It was determined that they jumped out of the window, made their way to the locked gate on the barbed wire fence that surrounded the island, and unfastened the gate bolts with the wrench. The wrench was actually left behind, and it did not belong to the prison. Each wrench that belonged to the prison was accounted for, so how they got this tool is unknown. The path beyond the gate led down to the shoreline and towards freedom. The thing that they had not prepared for was the terrible storm that day. The fog was extremely dense, and they may have thought that this was to their advantage, but in reality, no small vessels were allowed in the water that day because of it. There were powerful currents fluctuating between 7 and 9 knots that were pushing the water out through the Golden Gate Bridge and into the Pacific. The conditions were extremely dangerous that day, and it's unlikely that Roe and Cole knew what they were getting into. Theodore Cole and Ralph Roe made the headlines. Titles like "Island Legend Shattered" were plastered all over the news. They proved that the island was not as escape-proof as everyone thought. The day after the escape, the San Francisco News published an article titled, "Drowned in Bay, That's Alcatraz Felon's Fate, Searchers Believe." It also had a front-page article titled, "Heaviest Fog in 20 Years, Blanket City," followed by subtitles that said, "Tide at Highest Mark," and "Floodwaters Streaming into Bay Help Establish New Record." The storm was no joke. Despite the assumption that the two had either sunk or been swept out to sea, Cole and Roe were on the FBI's most wanted list for a long time. For several weeks after the escape, there were numerous reported sightings of the pair, and even claims from witnesses of crimes that Theodore Cole and Ralph Roe were the ones who committed them. The FBI followed up on every lead, but all of them were dead ends. In the months after the escape, every corpse found in the bay was investigated, but their bodies were never found. Rumors still circulated that Roe and Cole were alive. An article in the San Francisco Chronicle in April of 1941 claimed that Roe and Cole were living in South America and stated that they had both lived in Chile and Peru. Did they actually make it? Before the escape, Roe and Cole had told two of their friends at Alcatraz that if they made it, they would receive a letter saying that business was good in whatever month the letter was written in. According to these inmates, one of them received a letter in July of 1938 sent by a woman, and the letter said, "Business was good in July." The article discussed this letter and claimed that four prisoners had seen a letter saying that Roe and Cole were safe and an oil can had saved them. The article stated, quote, "Roe and Cole made good their escape attempt with two large airtight oil cans. The cans were strapped together and sealed into one of them were civilian clothes. It was in these clothes that the two Oklahoma desperados fled northward on the Redwood Highway. They contacted the automobile of a Confederate on Marin County Road, but they drove away alone." End quote. The article further went on to say that the airtight raft was waiting for them on the shoreline, but it didn't specify how it got there. It also said that there was, quote, "an indication that they were aided by a small boat and taken to a designated spot on Marin County shore." End quote. The article claimed that the two had fled to the Mexican border and were smuggled out of the country. It also claimed that they now had money and lived comfortably. Where all of this information came from and whether or not it's true is completely unknown and remains a mystery. We'll get into the 1962 escape from Alcatraz right after this message from our sponsors. On the morning of June 12, 1962, the guards began their routine headcount at 6:50 a.m. Correctional Officer Bill Long was in charge of the count that morning. The morning alarm bell rang, telling the prisoners that it was time to get out of bed for counts. Around 7:15 a.m., one of the guards called over to Bill, saying that one of the prisoners wouldn't get out of bed. Officer Long walked over to cell B-138 and instructed the inmate to get up, but they remained in bed. He reached in and touched the prisoner's head, which to his surprise and bewilderment rolled off the bed and fell to the floor. Shocked, he jumped back as another officer yelled, "There's another one over here!" And another officer yelled, "And here too!" The inmates all broke out into cheers. They had done it. Three men had successfully escaped Alcatraz. The escape alarm was sounded, and an extensive search began. The whole island was put on lockdown. The FBI and the Coast Guard were alerted, and guards, highway patrol, sheriff deputies, and local policemen searched land and sea for the men. On June 11th, 1962, the lights went out at 9:30 p.m. as they always did. Counts had been taken, and guards would continue to walk the cell blocks throughout the night. This night was different, though. These three inmates at Alcatraz had been planning an escape for months, 7 months to be exact. And for those inmates, tonight was the night that they would see it through. Their names were John Anglin, inmate 1,476, Clarence Anglin, inmate 1,485, and Frank Lee Morris, inmate 1,441. John and Clarence were brothers, just 1 year apart in age. They were born in Georgia, and they were 2 of 14 children. Growing up, they had little money, so they began committing small burglaries with their brother Alfred. As they got older, their crimes became more serious. Ultimately, the three brothers were caught after a bank robbery in Alabama. They were all sentenced to serve time in United States Penitentiary, Atlanta, where they met Frank Lee Morris. Later on, Clarence was transferred to United States Penitentiary, Leavenworth, and shortly after that, John was transferred there as well. At Leavenworth, John was caught helping Clarence attempt to escape. John had worked in Leavenworth's bakery, and he cut the top and the bottom off of 2 bread boxes and stacked them together. Clarence stood inside of them while John pushed the boxes into the kitchen elevator. A guard noticed, and this landed them both a ticket to Alcatraz. John was transferred first, arriving on October 22, 1960. Clarence arrived on the island a few months later on January 16, 1961. Clarence's admission card specifically stated that he was not to cell with his brother because both of them were escape risks. Alcatraz cells only held 1 inmate each, so this wasn't an issue. They had, however, been placed in adjacent cells, cell B150 and B152. I'm not sure if the warden was being lenient or if this was overlooked, but allowing them to cell together also allowed them certain privileges. Prisoners were allowed to quietly converse and even play games with the person in the adjacent cell. Your cell neighbor was also who you would sit by in the mess hall for meals. In the start of the prison's history, talking in the mess hall was forbidden, but as the years passed and time went on, this rule became much more relaxed. This allowed the prisoners the chance to talk about plans for an escape. Frank Lee Morris was 6 cells down in cell B138. He had been sent to Alcatraz on January 20, 1960, after a failed escape attempt from United States Penitentiary, Atlanta. Around 8:30 p.m., one of the correctional officers in Atlanta heard a loud crash and ran to see what was going on. Morris, trying to conceal his identity, ran towards the officer, trying to sneak back into his cell unnoticed. This wasn't the only time Morris had tried to escape. In fact, he had an extensive record of escape attempts. On his Alcatraz admission card, it actually lists escape artist as his occupation. His admission card also said something else that was very unique. Frank Lee Morris had an IQ of 133, meaning he had super intelligence. A score of 133 is just 7 points shy of being considered a genius. Morris's intelligence put him in the top 2 percentile of the human population. It's believed that Frank was the mastermind behind this escape and the reason that their attempt was successful. Well, maybe. Even though he was extremely smart, many believed that Morris's path of life was destined. He was born in Maryland in 1926 to a runaway teenage mother. He was orphaned at the age of 11, and he was shuffled from foster home to foster home, occasionally living with his aunt and her kids. He committed his first crime at the age of 13 and was charged with burglary. At 14, he was arrested again for burglary, and sentenced to spend 6 years and 9 months at the National Training School for Boys in Washington, D.C. While he was there, his teachers thought that he was highly intelligent, however, he also had violent outbursts. Once, he was caught stealing oranges from the kitchen and a senior officer told him to put them back. He refused, so the officer said that he was going to receive punishment for his actions. Once the officer turned to leave, 14-year-old Morris threw a large kitchen knife at him.
Ow!
Thankfully, he was only struck with the blunt end of the knife. Morris received heavy discipline for this, which led him to begin planning his escape. He did, and was listed as a runaway. Over the next few years, he had periods of freedom and periods of imprisonment. He had committed a multitude of crimes, from possession of narcotics to armed robbery. He had repeated escapes, and eventually he turned to committing large bank heists. After successfully breaking into and robbing a bank with two accomplices, he was apprehended by the FBI, captured, and sent to United States Penitentiary, Atlanta, where he met the Anglin brothers. After his failed escape attempt here, it was thought that sending him to Alcatraz would finally stop his string of escapes, but little did they know, it would challenge him to his most daring and extensive escape yet. In December of 1961, the plan had started to take shape, but according to an inmate named Alan Clayton West, it all started back in May of 1961. What a lot of people don't know is that the escape initially involved six men, not three. It's also thought that many of the prisoners knew of their plans and were rooting for them and even aided them at times. I'll walk you through it all, starting from the beginning. Alan Clayton West actually had served two terms at Alcatraz. He was first sentenced in April of 1954 and known as inmate 1130. He was released and sent back in June of 1958 after transporting stolen vehicles. This time, he was known as inmate 1335. The inmates at Alcatraz were rarely referred to by their names and only their numbers. West had a history of aggressive escape attempts, which had landed him at Alcatraz in the first place. Like the others, West had also spent some time at United States Penitentiary, Atlanta, and he had initially met John Anglin during a stint at a Florida state prison. During his second stint at Alcatraz, he stayed in cell B-140, right next to Frank Lee Morris. While it's suspected that Morris and his superior intelligence had a lot to do with planning the escape, West claims that he was the mastermind behind it all. He stated that he was working on his routine painting assignment and he had been assigned to paint the cell block roof. The cell block roof was located a few feet below the roof to the actual cell house. While he was up there, he noticed that one of the ventilators on the cell house roof had not been cemented shut like the others had. He thought it would be possible to get on the cell house roof through that opening if they could remove the vent cover. He also claimed that on a different painting assignment, he noticed that one of the vent ducts ran down the side of the cell house, allowing them a way to get down. Shortly after making these discoveries, plumbers were working in the utility corridors, which ran between the cells in every block. I'll share a picture of the blueprints on the Mystic and Murder Instagram page, so make sure to check that out to get a good understanding of the prison layout. The plumbers had made a bit of a mess, and West was assigned to clean it up. While picking up the garbage from the floor, he found an old, wadded-up piece of paper. Inside, there were rusty blades that looked like they had been there for a very long time. Another inmate and one of West's buddies, Clarence Carnes, confirmed that those were stashed there by an inmate who attempted to escape in 1939. According to West, he brought John Anglin into his scheme first, and they determined that the most secretive way to make it up to the roof would be to dig out the 6-inch by 9-inch vents in the back of their cell. If they dug around them, they could make a big enough hole to climb through into the utility corridor. Then, they could climb up the pipes all the way to the cell house roof. They would have to drill around the vent in the ceiling so they could push it up and get on the roof, but Once they were on the roof, they'd climb down the vent duct on the side of the building, run towards the shoreline, and get into the bay. West claims that the rest of the participants were brought into the plan in December of 1961. Over the next 7 months, there was a lot of preparation done by Alan West, John and Clarence Anglin, Frank Lee Morris, and two other inmates with prior escape attempts named June Stevens, inmate 1,225, and Woodrow Wilson Gainey, inmate 1,520. Like the Anglin brothers and Morris West, Stephen and Gainey were in adjacent cells, but they were located on the third floor of the B block. They had started in on the attempt, but Morris later asked them to pull out because their plan was just too risky and dangerous to attempt from the third floor. The first thing they needed to do was figure out a way to dig out of their cells. To do so, they ended up using spoons. Honestly, when I first heard this, I had no clue how you would go about digging an 8-inch cement wall with a spoon. But here's how they did it. They would break off the bowls and sharpen the handle down to a point. Now, it could serve as a little drill to create holes in the wall. When they began digging around the vents, they did it in a way that could go undetected. Because each of them had a cell adjacent to another, one person would dig while the other person was on the lookout. To conceal any noises from the digging and drilling, they dug during the prison music hours. Alcatraz inmates were allowed to purchase musical instruments and play them quietly between the hours of 5:30 p.m. to 7 p.m. This meant that there was plenty of noise that easily masked the sounds of their digging. Then, there was the issue of the holes being visible, so they came up with a way to conceal them. Once they finished a hole, they would fill it with soap and toilet paper. Prisoners were also allowed to paint as a recreational activity, so they were able to mix up the perfect shade of mint green to blend it in with the wall. Any debris that fell onto the floor was picked up and flushed down the toilet. Eventually, they even made fake vent covers out of cardboard tobacco boxes. The grill pattern on the fake covers were cut out using contraband razor blades. They also used items in their cell to conceal the area. Upon intake, each prisoner was given a manual of the institution rules and regulations, which specified how their belongings were supposed to be arranged in their cells. Personal property was supposed to be arranged on the shelf on the back wall of the cell, and only select items were allowed to be placed on the floor, including musical instruments. Morris hid the hole in his cell by placing a concertina case in front of it. That concertina will also come into play in their escape plan, but we'll get into that later. The Anglin brothers and West covered up the holes in their cells by hanging things like clothes or towels from the shelf above it. West decided to leave his grill intact to avoid arousing suspicion of any maintenance workers who might use the utility corridor. Remember how West was working on a painting assignment on top of the cell block? Well, that became a major advantage in this escape plan. While painting the ceiling of the cell block, debris would fall down onto the floor of the cell house below. West actually managed to convince the guards to allow him to hang blankets up to contain the mess. In reality, this space became a secret workshop where they prepared for their escape. Morris was also granted a work detail painting the cell block roof. Instead of painting, he was working on loosening the bolts to the ventilator. The men were also able to hide a lot of the tools that they used in the escape up there. That way, they would be less likely to be caught with contraband in their cells. The next part of their plan was to make fake dummy heads that looked like themselves in order to fool the guards during night patrol. The prison remained dark throughout the night, but guards would continuously parole and make sure that nothing was out of sorts. The men had decided their best chance of escape would happen at night. In order for their plan to go undetected and give them some extra time, they needed the guards to think that they were in bed and nothing was amiss. The dummy heads were made from a wire base that gave it shape. Then, chips of soap, concrete, plaster, glue, and paint were used to create a side profile of their face. They also took banded up pieces of human hair and glued them to the heads. Clarence Anglin worked in the prison barbershop, which is how the hair was acquired, and the glue was stolen from the glove shop. When I say that the hair was banded, I mean they took pieces of hair and aligned them in a way that would look natural, tied the pieces of hair together at the bottom, and then glued it to the head. Gluing random pieces of hair all over the heads would be too obvious and weird-looking. Banding it gave the hair a natural and realistic appearance, just like a wig would. The fake heads were not only incredibly useful on the night of their escape, but they had used them several times prior to that. Frank Lee Morris and John Anglin were the first to dig out the holes in their cell. John actually helped Clarence finish digging out his hole from behind in the utility corridor. The men would take turns working out of their cells, and while they were gone, they would place the dummy head in their bed so they could go undetected. In May of 1962, Clarence was the first to climb the pipes of the utility corridor all the way up to their hidden workshop on the cell block roof. He attempted to loosen up the screws on a metal coupling that secured the ventilator with a stolen screwdriver, but had no luck. They would need something better to get that ventilator cover off. At one point, West learned of a broken vacuum in the jail. He was actually permitted to repair it. He discovered that it had two motors, and he managed to get it working again with only one. He then took the second motor and gave it to Morris, who turned it into a motorized drill to use on the ventilator. While they were working on the ventilator, they were also working on a huge and very important part of their plan. They were constructing life jackets and a raft out of rubber raincoats. Frank Morris had gotten the idea from a magazine called Popular Mechanics. In the March 1962 issue, there was an article published on life preservers, and it even showed how to make your own. Typically, any books or magazines would be vetted before giving it to a prisoner or allowing it in the library, just in case there was anything useful in there that could help a prisoner escape. This article, though, had somehow been missed. The men used over 50 life jackets, some of which were stolen, and some were donated by other inmates to create life vests for themselves, as well as a 6-foot by 14-foot raft. They cut out the panels of the raincoats, stitched them together, and glued all the seams. They then used a technique to vulcanize or harden the rubber at the seams by using hot steam pipes. Doing this would create a watertight bond between the rubber molecules, sealing their seams together. This idea also came from an issue of Popular Mechanics, both of which were found in Morris's cell. Another magazine found in Morris's cell was the May 1962 edition of Sports Illustrated. This issue of the magazine was all about water sports, boats, and floats. There was a great amount of detail on the air chambers and valves on floats, and it mentioned that most were composed of vinyl plastic or rubberized fabric. It also mentioned how a boat arrives at a dock, how to tie a boat to a dock, and how to leave the dock. So at this point, the men have the holes in their cells all dug out, with the exception of West, who left the vent grill in place. They've created their dummy heads, and they've made life jackets and a raft to escape on, as well as wooden oars to paddle with. They're pretty much ready to go. As a little side note here, in all of my research, I was unable to find where they got the scrap wood for the oars in the first place. So if anyone knows or has any ideas, please let me know. Comment on Instagram, tweet me, send me an email, whatever. I would love to hear your thoughts. That's actually where we're going to leave off for part one, and the next episode is going to be released soon. In part two, we're going to talk about the night of the escape and all of the theories of what could have happened to Morris and the Anglin brothers, who were never found. Did they drown in the bay, or did they make it to land? If they did, how did they do it, and where did they go? This mystery is still unsolved, but we are going to dive into all of the possibilities next time. That's all for today's episode. New episodes of Mystic and Murder will be posted every other Sunday. Tune in, follow, and subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and more. You can find the podcast on Instagram and Twitter at Mystic and Murder. You can send an email to mysticandmurder@gmail.com with suggestions, requests, and even personal spooky stories. If you like what you hear and you want to support the podcast, you can go to www.patreon.com/mysticandmurder. You can click support at anchor.fm/mysticandmurder. You can make a donation at paypal.me/mysticandmurder. Or you can buy Mystic and Murder merchandise. Head to www.mysticandmurder.com/shop to learn more. Thank you all so much for listening, and I hope you sleep tight. Remember, all things weird lurk.